This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 56 was recorded on September 11th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. I want to apologize to our loyal following of Energy Week followers. We've had a crazy series of events. There were 2 weeks that were an intentional holiday that we took from producing Energy Week. Then we had a crazy outage with the Zencastr system that we use for our recordings. Had a global outage on the day last week that we attempted to record Energy Week. And this week, we had a couple of panelists called out of town and had to replan. To make it up to you, I have managed to get Dr. Anas Alhaji, who is now in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, on a call so that we can do a quick All-Stars update with Anas, and we hope to be back with a full Energy Week episode next week. So joining me now is Dr. Anas Alhaji from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Since you're in Riyadh, Anas, I want to start with Saudi Arabia. What the heck is going on? It seems like a couple of weeks ago there was an announcement that Khalid Al-Falih, who's been the energy minister, was still in power, but there was going to be a change and he would be sharing his authority with another person who was coming into power. But Al-Falih was still in, for sure. And now it seems this week that Al-Falih is out. This leaves international investors who probably don't understand the culture of Saudi Arabia nearly as well as you do, really kind of wondering what's going on. Is there an upset in the kingdom where they're not really sure who's in charge? Why are things changing so quickly?
Well, Eric, luckily, there is no change in oil policy. It is related to non-oil policy. So I'm going to go over the changes, explain it to people and what's been going on. It started with splitting the Ministry of Energy, Industry and Mineral Resources into two. Energy on its own and the Industry and Mineral Resources on its own. And Khalid Al-Falih remained the energy minister at that time. They appointed a guy with the name of Bender Al-Khurayef, the Minister of Industry and Mineral Resources. Bender comes from an industrial family, and they have many factories. He had great background in industry, etc. The other change that happened was Aramco chairman of the board position basically has been changed too. Al-Falih used to be the chairman, and then he was replaced by a guy with the name of Yasser Al-Rumayyan. Yasser Al-Rumayyan basically is the head of the PIF, the Saudi Sovereign Fund, which in a sense will end up owning the majority of Aramco. The third change basically is Al-Falih was the chairman of the board and he was a board member. So he was removed from the chairmanship and then he lost his seat on the board and he was replaced by a guy with the name of Nabil Al-Amoudi, who is the transportation minister. If you look at the board of Aramco today, it has 11 members, 10 men and 1 woman, 5 Saudis and 5 foreigners, in addition to the CEO of Aramco. 4 of the Saudis are ministers. That include Ibrahim Al-Assaf, who is the foreign minister, and he's an old-timer. He's been there for a long time. Mohammed Al-Jad'an, who is the finance minister, Nabil Al-Amoudi, who is the transportation minister, and I mentioned earlier, and Mohammed Al-Tawadri, minister of the economy and planning. It is very clear from this change, even before removing Al-Falih, that they are moving to the financial era of Aramco, which requires more experience in finance and law than petroleum engineering or oil politics. There are enough people with oil expertise on the board, whether they are the locals or the foreigners. So there is enough oil expertise on the board. They needed people who can do the IPO. The objective, after all, is the IPO. So you choose people who can do the IPO. After the IPO, we might see another change in the board, depending on the objectives at that time. So if you look at the United States, for example, or other companies, there are many chairmen of the boards of companies who have no hand-on experience in the products of the company. So it's natural, basically, to have Yasser Romayan as the chair of the board at Aramco, although he had not that much experience in oil. But he's been a board member for a long time, since 2016, I think, of Aramco. But at this time, it is the financial era of Aramco, and they need someone in finance to do the IPO. In general, and this is right in your area of investment and others on your show, in any investment venture, you need the interest of investors and the managers and others to be aligned. And in case of Aramco, you need Aramco to be aligned with the vision of 2030. And Yasser Romayan, in this case, is the right man for the job in the financial era of Aramco at this phase. So in a sense, I am not even surprised if at a later phase he will change simply because of the requirement of that time. And again, Yasser Romayan is the right person for the job since he is the head of the PIF, which is ultimately is going to be the main shareholder of Aramco. So those people who are saying he is, and probably you've seen an article or some people at Bloomberg basically saying that he is not fit for the job, those guys do not know what the difference between the job of the chairman and the job of the CEO, and they don't know Yasser Romayan and his abilities. I mean, this guy controls one of the largest funds in the world. To sum up this idea here is, and I'm just talking about the changes and the splitting of the industry in this case, we are moving toward more specialization, more alignment, more distribution of power at the lower level, but more concentration of power on the higher level since most of the people on the board and other places are basically appointed by Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince. So there is more distribution of power at the lower level, but more concentration of power at the higher level. Then later on after this, and everyone thought things settled down and Al-Faleh will be the energy minister since he was the face of OPEC diplomacy and the Saudi oil policy, that he will stay. But based on what we heard, that there was a meeting that's supposed to last for 2-3 hours and lasted for about 12 hours. And then after that, he was dismissed. He was replaced by Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, who is the son of the current king. And he's been there at the ministry for a very long time. So this guy comes on his own without being a royal, without being even the son of the king, in his rights, basically. He comes in with massive experience. When it comes to OPEC politics, Prince Abdulaziz is master at that. He comes to office with unprecedented experience and knowledge of oil market economics and politics, whether what he studied in school or what he actually practiced. The guy attended more OPEC meetings than any current OPEC official. He participated in the making of the Saudi policy since the 80s. In a sense, he is the institutional memory of the Saudi oil policy and OPEC. So the guy on his own, regardless whether he's the son of the king or not, the guy is fit for the job. While the Saudi policy or the Saudi oil policy is not expected to change, it is expected to remain the same simply because Prince Abdulaziz been there in every meeting that Al-Faleh attended. He was part of the members of the group that drove the Saudi oil policy. The Saudi oil policy is not made by one person. It's not made by the minister. So we are not expecting any change in the policy at all at this stage. However, we might see changes in the non-oil side, which probably led to the dismissal of Al-Faleh. So in a sense, Al-Faleh probably was dismissed because he did not deliver on the IPO, as many people believe, and then because of other issues related to the rest of the energy sector. That includes solar, that includes energy efficiency. And the most interesting part, whether we are going to see a push for nuclear energy under the new minister, since he comes in with unprecedented power being a royal and the son of the king. After all, it is the Ministry of Energy. It's no longer the Ministry of Oil. It covers electricity. It covers renewable energy, mostly solar, but they have some wind. It covers energy efficiency. It covers natural gas and LNG. And it covers nuclear. Here I would like to point out the accomplishment of Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, because I think this replies to some questions about whether he was appointed as a royal or not. There is the Center for Energy Efficiency in Saudi Arabia, which is in charge of all the energy efficiency, including the STAR program, which is similar to the STAR program in the United States. This center was the brainchild of Prince Abdulaziz, and he pushed for it, he established it, he managed it. So he had true experience and accomplishment on the energy efficiency side. He also basically worked on CAPSARC, which is the King Abdullah Center for Petroleum Research. And this is the largest, literally the largest and the richest energy research center in the world. And that is, as you know, is headed by Adam Siminski, who was the head, the former head of the EIA under the Obama administration. It's a massive center. And that was because of him. He is the one who worked on it. He brought it in. It has a massive budget, and it does a lot of research. And he brings in these additional experiences that people are not aware of. So generally speaking, he comes in with massive experience, massive accomplishment, but the oil policy of Saudi Arabia is not going to change. The Saudi policy basically is based on the idea that Saudi Arabia is a swing producer that is built for or to ensure market stability. And of course, there is no stability in the oil market, so the job will be just to lower volatility.
Anas, obviously, for many of us in the West, we don't really know who these individuals are. I have to confess my own ignorance of not even knowing who Abdulaziz was until a few days ago. Have you ever met this man personally? Do you know anything about him that you can share with our listeners?
Yes, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, he's one of the sons of King Salman. I've known him for over 25 years. I work with him personally on a couple of projects. And he is an amazing person, and I feel sorry for anyone who will work with him because he is a workaholic, and I think he will work them out really, really hard. People who work with him know that he works very, very long hours and sometimes 2 and 3 days without any sleep.
Anas, before we move on to our next topic, Khalid al-Fali has been in that position for, I'm not sure how long it is, but many, many years. And there's a whole legacy there. So what will become of Khalid al-Fali, and what will happen to the legacy of his presence as one of the most important players in the oil market?
Correct. Al-Fali used to be the CEO of Aramco, and of course, he left a big legacy there. But I want to focus on what happened since 2016, basically, until now, when Al-Fali became the energy minister. And basically, he left several legacies, but the most important two is the ability to move from being the face of the Saudi oil diplomacy to being the face of the diplomacy of 24 countries that constitute the group that we call now OPEC Plus. And the second legacy, basically, is the ability to navigate and overcome extremely adverse conditions in the oil market. Since this guy came in, if you look at the number of adverse incidents that hit the oil market and kept oil prices low, I don't know whether this is record high or not, but we got one after the other. So we ended up with Iraq increasing production substantially. And then we have the Obama nuclear deal with Iran, where Iran increased production substantially. Then we have the comeback of Libya. Then we have the comeback of Nigeria. And then we have the massive increase in shale production. So if you count all of those, I mean, we had many adverse effects, and he was able to navigate through that. So these are the two most important legacies of Al-Fali.
I want to move on now, because we haven't had our Energy Week podcast in a few weeks now, so there's quite a bit of news to update our listeners on. Let's start with the OPEC report that just came out. Give us the executive summary.
Well, for OPEC report, basically, the demand for oil is weak, generally speaking. They have minor revision, so they expect demand growth in 2019 to be around 1 million barrels. That's a revision of about 400,000 barrels from the initial report at the beginning of the year. But the most interesting part in the report, basically, is the demand for OPEC oil. So we have the global demand for all the oil, And then OPEC calculate basically what we call the call on OPEC. And the demand for OPEC oil since last year declined by 1 million. And it is expected to continue to decline. So this is a sign that probably if we are not going to see a decline in shale or some surprises of decline from non-OPEC, OPEC has no choice but to have another cut. So we have this meeting coming up on September 12th in Abu Dhabi. That's for the GMMC. The technical meeting is going to be on Wednesday, and then the GMMC is going to meet on Thursday, and that will be six countries, including the Saudi energy minister, the prince, and Novak of Russia, and others, including the head of OPEC. And they will be faced with those numbers, and whether they are going to cut or not. My sense is, before the change in the ministerial position in Saudi Arabia, that there will be a proposal for another cut. But now it is very clear, because of the change with Prince Abdulaziz, it is in the interest of the ministry and the policy of Saudi Arabia to keep everything as is for a while. And therefore, we are left for the December meeting, and that meeting will be interesting. So we are not going to see any recommendations of cut in production on Thursday, but for December meeting, we might see talks of another cut if we don't see stability in the market.
Russia released a report, I believe it was yesterday or the day before, which really took me by surprise. I believe that it is actually calling for at least the possibility of $25 oil prices. First of all, what are they thinking about $25 oil prices? But more to the point, even if Russia believes that that's what's going to happen, how would it be in Russia's interest to tell the world that that's their forecast?
Eric, the funny thing about the report is the fine print of the report becomes very important. There are too many scenarios and too many ifs. And that the media cited like the extreme if in this case. So they have a scenario where you have a major decline in oil demand and major increase in supply. And in this case, you end up with a $25 oil. So this is just a scenario, but the media focused on it relative to the other scenarios. The irony in this report is, and others that talk about $20 and $25, is there is no way in a normal market, if we don't have like this massive depression, there is no way we are going to end up with any price like this for a long time. We might end up with something like this probably in a week or two, but not more than that. And the reason why, because we are going to see massive response from investment and supply. And we are going to see reaction from OPEC. We are going to see shale producers basically reacting to it. So yes, if there is a possibility in case of depression that prices will go that low, but they are only short-term phenomenon and they are not going to stay.
The other big news that occurred this week was, first on Tuesday, we had the news that John Bolton had been fired by President Trump. That caused oil to take a nosedive, but not too much of a move. And then on Wednesday morning, the rumor, at least, I'm not sure whether it's really confirmed or not, has been that the reason for Bolton being terminated is that President Trump is seriously considering easing the sanctions on Iran, and apparently there was a falling out between President Trump and Bolton, who felt that they should not do that. And that, of course, resulted in a dramatic drop in prices on Wednesday, the day that we're recording. What do you make of all this? Does this mean a change in market direction, or are we just having a knee-jerk reaction to a news event that's going to blow over?
As you know, perception matters. And what happened today basically is the perception of increase in production from Iran as a result of this. And we paid the price heavily for it today. Here is the problem. If you go back to candidate Trump and watch his speeches before even Bolton showed up anywhere, he was talking about very hawkish attitude toward Iran. His supporters bought into the idea. And there is no way for Trump, basically, who always promised to deliver to his supporters, that he is going to switch what he promised for in many speeches. He brought in Bolton because he agreed with the idea, not because he bought into Bolton ideas. And therefore, in my view, firing Bolton, and which, by the way, made a lot of people happy, from both sides, even Republicans. Firing Bolton does not change the Iran policy that much. It is very clear that from the media that Trump probably buying into the French proposal, because it was a French proposal to try to work out a deal with Iran where they can stop the enrichment and stop going above certain limit in lieu of some relaxation of the sanctions. Here is the problem. Unlike what some media outlets are saying, the Iranian oil is reaching the market. The only difference any easing is going to do is the ability to pay the Iranians for their oil, or at least pay them legally. So while we are not going to see that much change in the physical market as a result, even if Trump changes his policy and allows some relaxation, we are not going to see that impact on the physical market, but we are going to see an impact on the finances of Iran, because now they can get paid and legally can get paid. So the impact on the oil revenues, but not on the amount of oil that is already available in the market.
Finally, Anas, we have the IEA coming out with their monthly report tomorrow, and then we have the JMMC meeting, and eventually in a few months we're going to have some of the longer-term forecasts. For all of these events, please give us the overview of what you expect.
The IEA tomorrow basically is the monthly oil report, and the expectation is that is going to show lower demand and probably a major revision on the demand side, which again bring us back to the earlier discussion about OPEC meeting in December, whether they're going to cut or not. So really that's the major issue about the IEA tomorrow. For the JMMC, I expected earlier before the ministerial change in Saudi Arabia that there will be an additional cut. Now I think that changed. I think everything will remain the same. The objective is to make the market kind of calm down and be assured that the Saudi policy is not changing, because if they cut production, people will attribute that to a major change in policy because of the change and the replacement of Al-Faleh. So they are trying to avoid all this noise by keeping everything as is. You mentioned long term. Generally speaking, I think there will be a time when we are going to have the outlooks for OPEC and the IEA that will be released, I think early next year. But given what they already released now, the main characteristics of the long term basically is major increase in shale, major penetration of electric vehicles, a major improvement in engine efficiency in internal combustion engines. And all of those assumptions basically are questionable. Probably you've seen a discussion on Twitter in recent days regarding the future of electric vehicles. And it is very clear that the top experts in the field have a major assumption, and it is the correct assumption, that it is all depend on government policies. And those government policies are very expensive and they need money. And if government do not need money, then those outlooks will change.
And one final question, Anas, before I let you go, which is, before the Trump-Bolton news took over the market, we saw quite a reaction to yet another really big drawdown in crude oil inventories. Now, Anas, when you first predicted that we might have as low as 400 million barrels as a storage number, a lot of people thought you were crazy. We get down to 417 today, so we're very close to your numbers. And I think at some point, there's kind of an inflection point where you get below certain critical levels and it becomes very bullish. At what point does this really start to have a profound impact on prices?
I think we were very close today and we are getting to it. I am still bullish on oil right now. I think it was the Saudi policy to lower exports to the United States that contributed substantially to the lower storage, and that Saudi policy have proven to be successful. I think we are going to go to 400, and the possibility of going below 400 is real. And I think that threshold of 400 is going to be extremely critical for traders and others. And people are going to wake up to find out that if we are going to go below 400, storage will be lower than where it was between 2012 and 2014, simply because the line fill that we had since 2015 until today is over 50 million. And therefore, the actual storage is really less than 350. And that's very low. And that's going to cause a major price spike. In addition, as you know, we always talked previously about the crude quality, and that's going to play a role too. So we are going to see a spike because of lower storage on one side and because of crude quality issues on the other.
Well, Anas, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy business schedule there in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to give us an update. And again, listeners, we do apologize for having missed a couple of episodes of Energy Week, but we hope to have a new Energy Week for you Wednesday next week. That will feature Anas Al-Haji again, along with Pat Hemsworth and Ola Hansen. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.